morning. Today is the last day of March. It's March 31st of 2015. And some of us that were born in the 40s or 50s, whatever. Anyway,
What about it?
The 30s.
No, not 30s.
The 40s. 40. I was born in the 40s. It's like, how did we get to 2015? But here we are, and the good thing is that Oregon is working together on education. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5024. And Mr. Cannon, are you going to get us directed and get us started since we're a little late?
Madam Chair, just for reference sake, the material on the screen right now is on yesterday's. It's under yesterday, and we may be moving on to the material that's under today's date part of the way through the meeting.
Only if all goes well.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HAC, and let's hope all goes well. We, again, have provided you with a letter responding to questions that arose yesterday. I want to note a couple of additional follow-up items that we'll be contacting you about. We mentioned them here, but I want to note some additional work that's underway by our staff. One is to provide, there was a question yesterday about dual enrolled students who are enrolled simultaneously in community colleges and universities. I believe the committee was interested in knowing how prevalent that is, as well as how sort of tuition was assigned. And we think the paragraph in the letter captures that generally, but we'll supply some additional details as we continue to outreach to the colleges and universities about their participation in that. In brief, they're all doing it, or most are doing it,
right,
at some level, and they're typically students pay tuition based on where they're taking the class. So if their class is a community college class, that's the tuition rate they pay. If their class is a university class, they pay the university tuition. And since they're mixing and matching, it's a blend of the two. But we'll supply some additional detail on that. We also have staff at OSAC working on the co-chair's question about FAFSA changes since 2005, so we're documenting those. Again, we've noted in the letter a few of them, but we'll supply some additional detail. And finally, really appreciate Representative Springer asking for contact information for Aspire sites in each of your districts. That's appended to the letter. We supplied some of the emails for the coordinators where those are public emails, namely, you know, school district employees who have made their contact information available publicly. We've included those. If you want to reach out to an Aspire coordinator listed on this sheet whose contact information we did not include, let our staff know, let me or our staff know, and we'll provide that, or we'll put you in touch with that coordinator. So those are listed by district. You get a sense of currently participating schools and sites in each of your legislative districts. All right, we are moving on. And so the pathways metaphor has been an important one for the commission. But at the outset, I think the commission, our commission, the HEC, had in mind a particular pathway. And it's really the conventional one. It's K-12 to higher education to workforce. And very often within higher education, it might have been community college to public university or other four-year university and to workforce. And I think at the outset, our commission actually paid insufficient attention to some of the other important and common pathways that students follow in and out of higher education and the workforce. And so, for example, many, many of our students, especially at community colleges, are on pathways from the workforce or from as working age adults into a community college setting where they may not be ready or prepared to take actual college level courses. And colleges help fill that gap through programs that go under the heading of adult basic skills, through GED programs for students who have not completed high school, through ESL programs for students who require English in order to access higher education or the workforce. And we also, I think, paid insufficient attention to the pathways from higher education back to the workforce and from colleges specifically and their role in workforce development and employment. And so, again, adult basic skills, GED, ESL courses may be ones that students are taking not primarily to earn a certificate or degree, but because they're seeking work opportunities, employment opportunities.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Ben, you know, I just left 8 years on the Mount Hood Community College Board, and we had three graduations every year, and they were all pretty significant in size. One was the GED graduation, and those students could be any age, from my age to high school age almost. Then we had graduation for Eastern Oregon University students. We had a satellite campus for Eastern Oregon, and those students, even though they were attending what is classically a rural institution, Eastern, most of them came from the Portland metro area, and for whatever reason were matriculating through Eastern, and they would graduate with a four-year degree on the Mount Hood campus. And then, of course, we had a regular Mount Hood Community College graduation, basically two-year programs. So every year I got to attend all three graduations, and it was interesting to see the disparity and the differences of students there that were moving along on the 40-40-20 spectrum.
And Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I think that's a good launching point to the discussion that we'll have today as we move from the sort of pathways and connection points we talked about yesterday, from K-12 to higher ed and from community college to universities. As we talk today, and I'll ask Jim and Krissa to lead this presentation, we talk about pathways from adulthood to college, from college back to the workforce, and that's where we're going to launch. So, Jim and Krissa.
Welcome, and we're glad you can join us. We love Ben, but you know, after 5 days, a little change up is helpful.
That's right. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you both. For the record, again, I'm Jim Middleton, serving as interim commissioner. For today, I'm going to turn most of this over to Krissa, and for a number of reasons. I think one of the most important reasons is that Krissa's going to hang it up at the end of this year and retire. And as deputy commissioner, I think we all recognize that there's people who aren't necessarily the lead badge that really keep things running and make the difference, make commissioners look good, and really keep things going. And Chris has certainly been that for quite some time, and will be sorely missed within CCWD and the state. And swan song.
Co-Chairs Monroe, members of the committee, my name is Krissa Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. So we'll jump in with the adult basic skills and how it supports the 40-40-20 goal. It is a secondary completion agenda. Through GED attainment in reading, writing, math, and English as a second language, the curriculum in the adult basic skills courses is designed to move students from ABS, which is non-credit, to credit post-secondary education.
And Chris, it's my understanding the fees on taking the assessments have increased in the past couple of years. Are you going to get to that about the testing and how you get your GED?
The fees have changed. There are now four tests instead of five. There's five tests instead of six, but we can give you that information.
Okay,
after
thank
this.
You.
I don't have it in here.
Okay, thank you.
So the GED provides the first credential and trajectory into post-secondary education. The curricular content is now aligned with the Secondary Common Core State standards, and this alignment precipitated a redesign of the GED tester series that was launched in January 2014. The adult basic skills learning standards are aligned also with the National College and Career Readiness Standards, specifically designed for adult students contextualized to the workplace. These are a subset of the secondary Common Core State Standards as well. The OPABS, Oregon Pathways for Adult Basic Skills, is industry contextualized curriculum that is also aligned to the National College and Career Readiness Standards. OPABS is designed to bridge over developmental education into career and technical education and career pathways programs. So again, it's non-credit to credit.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Krista, I always wonder the comparison between students that have achieved a GED and those that graduated from high school through a, you know, in a normal track. And we know that students that graduate from high school and enter college, a pretty high percentage of them don't have the basic skills they need for college. They have to take remedial classes in math and sometimes in language arts as well. I wondered if that was true also of GED graduates, or if any comparisons had been done in terms of college readiness between the two different disparate groups, those students who had, for whatever reason, dropped out of high school and later went and got a GED, and those students that went through the regular program, graduate from high school, and decide to go on to either community college or university.
Mr. Co-Chair Monroe, I can speak to that a little bit. Nationally, the data is not good on GED students moving on and getting the degree. This is one of the elements that, as I made mention yesterday of some of the developmental ed work that we're doing with that task force, is trying to not sweep that under the rug, but face that, look at it, build better bridges as we're looking at that right now. But the intent is to first move students into, you know, being active citizens, having them be more job prepared, and with the hope that we're also moving more and more of them into post-secondary study to a college certificate or degree. But the data has not been real strong as far as those completion rates, so that they are not mirroring the percentages that we get out of high school graduates. And again, part of that is, as you mentioned, many times people completing the GED are considerably older than the more recent high school graduates, so they have a family, they have other commitments, and it's harder for them with other life elements.
So follow up?
Yes, please.
So basically, most GED graduates, that's their terminal degree.
Mr. Co-Chair, statistically, yes, at this point. It's been a significantly less continuation into a post-secondary credential.
Thank you.
So, Senator Monroe, I would add to that the point of the everything be aligned with the Common Core State Standards. Mm-hmm. So there is an alignment. So then we're talking about high school completion for a high school student. We're talking about the same level of skills for an adult basic skills student. And that's why the GED had to change last year. So that these are all aligned. We're talking more like apples to apples instead of apples to oranges.
Thank you.
Okay. So on the next slide, passing the five subject areas certifies that test takers have the American high school level of academic skills. Repeat of what I just said, I guess. But this is showing you, Oregon is in the top, it's showing you the numbers that completed the five tests and the numbers that passed all five tests. Oregon is in the top 10 states for GED completers. So 2013-14 is a transitional year between the two GED tests, so the complete information is not available yet on that. So we're going back to the 2012-13 data to show that 42% of our students were unemployed, another 32% were not in the labor force, and 58% of the students were male. And an answer to another of your questions, Senator Monroe, you see the age breakout of people taking the GED is all ages, as you were mentioning earlier. There's over 300,000 Oregonians who are 16 and older in an out of school, but they lack a high school diploma or equivalent. So it's about 12% of Oregon's population of 16 years and older and out of school that don't have the high school equivalency. Of the most recent 13-14 cohort of high school students, Oregon, almost 7,000 did not complete the requirements for a diploma. And within 4 years of high school, for a diploma within 4 years of high school. They did not earn an alternative certificate or a GED and had not enrolled at the high school for a fifth year. So that means 15% of the graduating high school cohorts are adding to that over 300,000 adults without the high school equivalency. So the Oregon Adult Basic Skills Learning Standards are aligned, as I said, with the National College and Career Readiness Standards. Alignment helps ensure that ABS students successfully transition from ABS work to credit post-secondary programs of study and to jobs. And part of the difference, one of the differences between DevEd and ABS is that ABS is non-credit and DevEd is credit. So our goal of ABS is to increase the number of literate Oregonians, target population with less than high school diploma or equivalent, or speak English less than very well. So each year we help about 16,000 students in the community colleges to develop the foundational skills they need to earn a GED. Repeat slide. So 16,204 students participated in 2013-14. 43% were unemployed, an additional 29% were not in the labor force, and 53% were male. I think I just repeated that. Courses build a pipeline of prepared adult basic skills in the OPEBS program. So that is the Pathways program for adult basic skills. And the goal is to enter post-secondary, bridge over DevEd, and land in training programs and jobs in high demand career areas. That curriculum has been designed specifically for OPEBS. It was designed here in Oregon, and it's something we've been working on for several years. OPEBS courses in reading, writing, and math are designed to bridge over DevEd and directly connect with career pathways, certificate, degree programs, and courses of study, and to develop formal connections with the one-stop centers to facilitate ABS learners' transition to further education and employment. So funding for adult basic skills is for every 15 cents of adult education, it's the federal funding, Adult Education Family Literacy Act, which is Title II of the Workforce Investment Act. 85 cents in general fund is contributed from the colleges.
Let me, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, let me make, you know, just a brief comment relative to this. It's very important to see that much of what we're doing in the adult basic skills is being sponsored not out of the state general fund, out of the community colleges' local general funds. So in other words, we are taking tuition dollars from the students paying for credit classes and using that to cover some of those adult basic skills. So it is a significant loss leader for the colleges and is a significant investment of outreach to bring those other citizens along, but in itself it does not pay its own way as we work our way through those challenges.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Over
Representative Smith Warner.
I'm sorry. I was trying to figure out when there's an event in the governor's. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could I just, could you just kind of walk through for me, somebody who comes seeking this? I'm just trying to make sure I have a good understanding in my head of kind of like, if one person walks in who, say, is in their 20s, is in one of those categories of doesn't have a high school degree, limited English, whatever, kind of how do they get steered down each of these pathways? Because that's the other thing I was trying to, like, just looking at the numbers, like your GED takers were all spread across different ages, a lot more in the 16 to 18, obviously. And then your adult basic skills takers were much more skewed towards a little bit older. So I just wondered, is it that you steer people towards GED or ABS, or do they all get the ABS and then some of them choose to take the GED and some of them choose to just go straight into the workforce? Can you kind of give me a sense of how that works?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and Representative Smith Warner, they come in a variety of ways, as you can tell, because of that. The numbers do look skewed. Not every student that takes a GED, or every person that takes a GED, has been in a community college ABS prep course. So there are other kinds of prep courses, so there are a lot more, which results in the bigger number. There's a variety of ways that people come into an adult basic skills program. They could have come, they might be a repeat person in the workforce, coming into WorkSource Oregon. They might be recycling, looking for jobs, and doing an assessment at WorkSource Oregon Center, and finding that their skills are low, and they need an upgrade. So they refer them to the community college program. That would be one way. Many of our adult basic skills students, English is their second language. Thinking of an example of, I've used often a man because it was pretty impressive, a man that was in a CNA program, a workforce program up in Mount Angel several years ago, was a doctor in Vietnam. His basic skills weren't in math. He needed language. So his goal was not to become a doctor in the United States, but his goal was to become a nurse practitioner. And I have no doubt that he made it because he was very motivated. His goal as being a CNA was to gain language that he needed for his job, which increases language in his community, in his home life. So there's a wide variety of who comes to these programs, including people that have a high school diploma that may have been out of school for 20 years and lost their job. They could end up in an adult basic skills program through a referral. There's a variety of ways.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then setting aside GED for a moment, so most of the folks that come into the adult basic skills or the pathways to basic skills are going to come in through workforce, which normal people would think of as unemployment. So you lost your job, you're going through a situation, you go to workforce. That's one of the things you do when you're trying to get in the workforce or you've lost your job, and they refer them, and you are referred through WorkSource to these adult basic skills. So then, two questions. I just lost the little thing that I'm looking at here. So how do you differentiate between people who just go through the adult basic skills versus the pathways, A? And B, do people get to decide if you have somebody who comes in and it turns out they don't have a high school degree? Are you always going to try to get them to do the GED, or is that up to them? Sorry.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and Representative Smith Warner. It is very individualized. Part of it is also through our partnerships with community agencies, as we're reaching out to different advocacy groups, making them aware of what some of those choices are. We try not to pigeonhole any particular group and say, oh, you're not college ready, so you have to go GED. It's really sitting there and working with those. Some of those are referrals from current employers looking at trying to upgrade someone. And much of it is that first very difficult step for people who are out of the system, really trying to improve their lot and improve their families. And then we do have individuals that they can speak to and start to say, here are the different educational products, which one works best for you. Clearly, if you have someone who's a non-speaker of English, that's where they're going to start, because they will not have the language skills to succeed at the GED or some of the other areas. and then we will find a number of the students whose math, writing, reading skills are below what we're even teaching in the credit developmental ed classes, and that's where they would be moved into the adult basic skills courses first.
Okay. And then, go ahead.
Senator Monroe, Representative Comp, Representative Smith-Warner, in addition to that, part of the OPAB's curriculum is individualized for the career. It includes career planning, career exploration, so people really can look at what they're interested in, look what their skills are, and have curriculum that matches that. That curriculum is tailored towards healthcare, business, I believe, and mechanical area. I don't have the right name for mechanical area. What is it?
Manufacturing.
There we go.
Places where there are jobs. Yeah.
It is, so they can, as my description of the man in the CNA course would fit that. So you get somebody into the coursework and into their career interests, their language does improve and increase more rapidly.
Thank you. And one last very short. Okay. So I guess I'm still trying to get to, if someone comes in, what is the determining factor of whether they just go to adult basic skills or OPABs? Because they seem kind of similar, but...
Okay. Senator Monroe, Senator, Representative Conference, Senator Smith-Warner, that within the ABS courses, their OPABs is in all of the community colleges. So if their path that they choose is in one of those, they would be directed to it. It's part of their curriculum.
Okay.
So it's not separate from, it's all in.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there still a pretest for the five tests in the GED that can be given ahead of time? A pretest that kind of lets them know where they're at?
Senator Monroe, Representative Comp, Senator Roblin, yes. There are pretests.
So, because I was going to try to help with Smith-Warner's question as well. I'll wait till she gets done. So, Representative Smith-Warner?
Yes.
I also wanted to just give you an explanation. Many of the high schools in the state offer GED prep for some of the kids that are about ready to graduate or aren't going to graduate, and they've recognized it. So there are some programs out there that are not just at the community colleges, not as many. Community colleges are the number one. And a lot of people come to the high school and figure out what to do, and we refer them to the community college that's nearest and say, they have this whole program for you. A number of them can give the GED pretest and let people know, you've got a long ways to go, you really need to go this, or some kids come in and do so well, they say, go take the test. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ready for you. So I think there's a lot of ways to get there, but really there's only one program. I mean, it's not a lot of programs. It's all of them lead to the next step to help the person decide where they want to end up. I think
Senator Monroe, Representative Comp, Senator Roland, that's correct. It'd be GED Options is a program in the high school.
Right.
And it has, it's a significant number of the people, for the people preparing, a significant number in the GED Options. You're correct.
So it's a whole system that's trying to help that 300,000 people, 400,000 people find a pathway to get to an education.
Thank you, Senator Roland.
Thank you.
I'll pick up next. I think one of the things as we look back in time, it used to be that you had a four-year degree or you had nothing. If you didn't get to that four-year point, you didn't have a credential. And then what we've done with the associate degrees is to come to a two-year credential that you could get. But we also recognize that there are a lot of very legitimate arenas where it's important to provide some type of credential that's even less than the associate degree. And there's been a lot of work nationally and in Oregon of what we call stackable credentials. So that, and that's really what the career pathways are. One of the best examples of that is when you look at something like automotive technician, and you'll actually go to the repair shop and you'll see people on their arm will have labels for certain areas that they are qualified for, and that's a number of areas are moving to what they call badges. So it's in that spirit that you get one piece, and you can build on top of that and build on top of that in a career pathway direction that gives you something along the way as far as accomplishment, demonstrates to employer that you have certain competencies, but also creates that motivation of showing that you're making progress rather than you just have more credits on a transcript. And this isn't a criticism, but at the university, you know, after the first year, you have credits on a transcript, but there isn't some other credentialing that you have. That's what's accomplished by the career pathways. All of that is then, moving on, is part of the broader career technical education, where I know there's always a lot of real interest in this important role that the community colleges serve, and I'll be talking about some of this in some of the following testimony. But it's really looking at where we combine the career training programs along with the academic skills, work experience, the job shadowing, the on-the-job training that leads to industrial certification. Much of that is very rigorous. It is not second rate or the second choice, and great respect for a lot of the students that build a lot of the STEM career skills that are really necessary for our continuing future.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm really just interrupting this time to call out something that on the slide before, I think that's one of the greatest quotes I've ever seen, because that really is so. That's exactly what you guys are doing is about, that whole opposite of stepping off a cliff, but instead being propelled upwards.
Yes.
Because that really, it completely changes people's lives. And I just wanted to point out what a great quote, and what isn't that what we want to do for everybody?
Absolutely.
So, thank you for sharing that.
The next really shows you what our progress has been on moving forward with these. And I think what is most important here is to see the attention with that green area, which really are those career pathway certificates. So there's been significant attention to this over the past several years, and we can see the significant growth in those, quadrupling the number of those credentials awarded since 2008. There is some drop-off with the certificates less than a degree. Some of that has been a shift of shifting some of those to career pathway kinds of orientation, and a hint for some of the rest is we've seen as we have gone through some of the funding challenges, we are unfortunately seeing a small diminution of what percentage of college enrollment is in the career technical arena. So there has been some pinching as those are the much higher cost programs, and so I think that may have been some of that early leakage of that in 2011 and 2012. And then finally, this is really looking at the national level. Career technical education is not just an Oregonian element. It touches virtually all high school students in some way. We talk about 12 million post-secondary students nationally who are involved in some type of work in this area. It is not just our work. It's the work of the high schools. It's the work of career centers, community technical colleges, as well as the four-year universities. It is organized through the 16 career clusters and over 79 pathways that we look at. It integrates. What's important here is it's not just skill training. It's a coordination of that with the appropriate academic skills that assist them in their career and professional development. It is important, and what we do with some of the concurrent enrollment in the high schools, where we get high school students getting college credit for career courses in the high school, that is another form of the dual enrollment that gives them the college level credits and gets them started on those career technical programs at the community college. It is part of our connection and commitment to emphasis on the high skill, high wage, high demand areas that really become part of a state economic driver. And then, as I mentioned before, it's trying to integrate a range of skills, not just train them for the skills of yesterday, but give them some of the ability to learn with their technical skills, but also other general academic skills that will prepare them for effectiveness within their communities.
Any follow-up questions? Thank you. And then, Doug, are we staying on this?
I believe we have one more presentation as part of this packet.
Okay, thank you.
Indeed you do. Again, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HEC, and joined by Whitney, who will introduce herself in a moment. Most of what you've been hearing today is funded through the agency's CSL budget, which includes positions associated with the programs that you described and sort of state support for the programs that you've heard about, as well as through our state investment in community colleges. Many of those dollars are federal. You'll see that when we get to the sort of agency budget later on. At this point, we're going to spend a few minutes on POPs 151 and 152 of the governor's budget, which describe a community leverage fund and innovation center, and I'll have Whitney talk about that. I would just note that I think part of what's become increasingly clear to educators and education policymakers and legislators is that we do some of our very best, most impactful work on student outcomes when we work in partnership at a regional level, when we're bringing together our early learning educators, our K-12 educators, our workforce system and employers, philanthropy to the table to describe common strategies for improving outcomes for students. So the project that is proposed within the governor's budget, a new project that Whitney will talk about, is not exclusively focused on higher education, not even exclusively focused on education, but the HEC is very happy to house it should the legislature decide to move forward with funding.
Thank you, Ben.
Good morning, Whitney.
Good morning, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee. So as Ben articulated, really the theory behind the community agenda that I'll describe for you is the theory that in order to reach our 40-40-20 goals, we need to acknowledge that at the community level, we have to be attentive to not only the education system, but also other conditions that exist in the community, such as health, connections with early learning, connections with workforce, and connections with economic development. These really represent not only the conditions that are necessary to reach 40-40-20, but also its ultimate promise of sort of thriving and prosperous communities. So we can go ahead to the so as Ben described, these are contained in two POPs, 151 and 152. We'll go ahead to the next slide. Over the past 4 years, the legislature has invested in systems, community-based systems, to achieve the transformations that we're looking for in these areas. We're looking at the coordinated care organizations, early learning hubs, regional achievement collaboratives, STEM CTE hubs, local workforce investment boards, and regional solutions committees. While each of these systems are different, they are all include the common elements of taking a regional approach, of being collaborations among public, private, local, civic partners, philanthropy, and other nonprofit organizations, and they are all have the purpose of empowering local communities to work on priorities that achieve our state's key outcomes. And you'll see on the slide listed the key outcomes that the collaboratives are working toward, which are increasing numbers of healthy children, stable and attached families, ready for kindergarten, reading by third grade, completing high school, earning degrees and certificates, and engaging in meaningful family wage work. Go ahead to the next slide. So the first element of the package is the Center for Community Innovation. The center is proposed within HEC. 5 FTE is listed here, but as Bill pointed out to me, there was also in the package an additional FTE, one FTE that would be transferred from the governor's office over to the HEC. The purpose of the center would be to serve as a state backbone for technical assistance, support, and dissemination of best practices among and between these various collaborative systems. Other key activities of the Center for Community Innovation would be to leverage and connect our state resources with private and philanthropic resources, work to remove barriers to transformation at the state level, help our regional partners have access to the data and best practices research that we have at the state level, and to really develop a statewide network for learning and sharing among and between these collaboratives.
Whitney, I have a question about the FTE. So and maybe it goes to Mr. McGee, but you say one person is going to come out of the governor's office. So is that person that is going to come out of the governor's office already listed in his budget and then will come to our budget? Or
Madam Chair, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. The governor's the actual budget package in HEC shows six FTE. The governor's budget shows a minus one FTE to correspond to the one that's being transferred. So from the state standpoint, it's a net of five.
Thank you.
And I'll just mention that the Center for Community Innovation, the idea of that was really modeled after what we've seen be a successful element of the healthcare transformation, which is the Transformation Center in the Oregon Health Authority. That system has really helped to both support the CCOs as they launch, but also to help transform the Oregon Health Authority itself in terms of an agency that is responsive to the community efforts. And so this would really take kind of a more take that approach and broaden it out between the other collaboratives that we have in place. Next slide. The second piece of the proposal is for a community leverage fund, and the purpose of the community leverage fund is to really help provide regions with the capacity to work collaboratively across these systems and to also to support on-the-ground projects that address multiple outcomes. I think you've heard in the last 2 days some really good examples of the kind of work that communities are tackling on the ground, and they're not doing it in isolation. So when we talk about efforts in accelerated learning, when we talk about the career pathways and career and technical education efforts that are happening, when we talk about efforts around K-12 linking with community college, these are all efforts that at the community level are being implemented in ways that cross over multiple sectors and multiple collaboratives. And so the Community Leverage Fund is really aimed at acknowledging that within these communities, they need some capacity to really have the kind of backbone infrastructure to help and make sure that all of these various programs that we're funding through agency budgets are aligned and have a place to really move us toward a common outcome. So how the fund would work, regions would designate a lead collaborative and an organization within that collaborative to receive a planning grant. The Center for Community Innovation would support the collaboratives within that region to come up with an investment plan that would then need to meet a set of criteria. The criteria that we're looking at include participation from at least two of these collaborative systems, a commitment to securing leveraged resources from private, local, or philanthropic sources, an actionable plan for improving two or more of the key state outcomes that I mentioned earlier, a commitment to engaging a diverse set of partners, and a sustainability plan and plan for measuring success. The Center for Community Innovation would then appoint an advisory committee, a cross-sector, geographically diverse committee to review the plans. And once a region submitted a plan that met the criteria, they would be awarded $2 million to implement the plan.
Well, I'm taking a breather because the first time, and Ben, don't fall over, when I saw the first bullet where it said planning grant of $50,000, I read it as $50 million. So I thought, oh, how are you going to do that?
Gasp.
Yeah, gasp is right. So I'm glad it's 50,000.
That's right.
Yes, Senator.
But it's the easiest, the same way we fund $300 million with a request with $60 million worth of available access. So same issue.
Yeah, right.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. Can you walk us through a little bit of how the $25 million would be spent in a little more detail, please? Because obviously the math down below does not.
Because that's what I was looking at. Right, the $25 million and $10 million.
Yes. co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Taylor. So there are 11 economic development regions in the state. Mm-hmm. Within those regions, each would receive a $50,000 planning grant, which comes to about $550,000 total.
Right.
And then upon approval of the plan would receive up to $2 million to implement. That leaves $2.45 million remaining. That would be used to fund cross-regional projects that touch on more than one region. And really, we tried to acknowledge that within these regions, there are multiple collaboratives. In some cases, there are more than one CCO. In some cases, there are early learning hubs that cross over more than one region. So that extra money was really aimed at ensuring that we could fully support collaboratives in the regions where they cross over more than one and have a ability to do projects that sort of acknowledge that complexity.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up, yeah.
Thank you, Chair Comp. So basically, if you're in one of the 11 regions, you're going to compete against each other for the $2
million.
You're going to get that money is going to go to, because you're going to divide it up between the 11 regions. So it's not necessarily prioritizing for the whole state. It's within each of those regions. They're going to apply for up to $2 million.
Representative Taylor, that's correct. So there's $2 million set aside for each region of the state. And what we would be doing in the process of supporting the development of an investment plan would be bringing these collaboratives together to come to a sort of shared mutual plan around how they wanted to invest their $2 million within that region.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Comp. So the $2 million, just some examples of how that money could be spent. Is that on teachers? What is this? Because obviously, in some ways, it's a lot of money. In other ways, it's not very much money,
right,
depending
right.
on how you look at it. But.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Taylor, thank you for that question. I'll give you a couple examples of the things that we've seen bubbling up across the state that have really led us to create this package to invest. An example from Malheur County. In that county, business leaders, education leaders, the ESD, the school districts, the community college have come together to create a kind of cross-sector collaborative called Poverty to Prosperity. And they looked at the kind of economic conditions in their community. They looked at the community need, and really the business leaders in the area looked at the kind of silos that they saw occurring between the community college and the ESD, and they saw some potential for resource by really moving to have these groups collaborate together. From that, they have developed a career and technical education plan in the area and have been investing in three separate career and technical education tracks in welding and in manufacturing, and I think allied health is the third. From that work, recently in economic development, they were able to attract the Fry Foods Company to come to Malheur County and develop a plan. And in part, they attribute that to the fact that they were able to point to a pipeline, a career and technical education program in the area that they had developed collaboratively that could supply the plant with the workers that they needed. And so that's the kind of thing that we're seeing. We're seeing communities, again, come together and acknowledge that many of these efforts are stronger and more cohesive when they actually bring all of the partners to the table to develop them. I'll give another example of a project. In Central Oregon, there is a collaborative approach called Better Together. And in that region, they're really focused on all the cradle-to-career continuum, and they've got projects that are started in all of the areas, so getting, you know, early literacy and children ready to read. They've got a program to get every student a mentor. Aspire is actually an element of their plan. And then they've got a career in technical education and career-focused pathway that they're working on. And so the idea would be through the community leverage fund that community could look at those various priorities and decide where it is that they felt they needed to really create this kind of connective tissue and to invest the dollars to make a difference.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
On that line, Whitney, we funded this current biennium money for STEM and STEM hubs? Is there connection between some of the work that was done in those STEM hubs with this?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, absolutely. I think one of the exciting things that we're seeing is that in some of the regions, the work of the STEM hub actually is really a part of the work of the Regional Achievement Collaborative. And in some places, it's, you know, the workforce boards are now taking that on as a priority, and the Economic Development Regional Solutions Committees taking that on as a priority. In other places, it's not. And that's the, those are the places that I think really we look to and say, well, if the STEM CTE hubs are operating in isolation from the education collaboratives and from the workforce boards and from the economic development, we're really not going to get our bang for the buck for the dollars that the state is investing. And so this is really aimed at making sure that those efforts are part of a kind of a aligned strategy within a region that's going to lead us not only to 40-40-20, but to the economic prosperity that we all hope for.
You just very astutely named four different areas. This is a big ask, but can you get us information on what those four different areas, how they've expended their money and what some of their outcomes are? For an example, the South Metro STEM is serving, I don't know, somewhere between 50 and 80,000 students in different school districts, but I don't know if they've gone beyond that to look at some of these workforce avenues or, I mean, because we've got, this committee's got a lot of tough decisions to make here in the next few weeks. And yeah, when you're talking about four different entities, and yet, yeah, what are their outcomes and how are anything that you can give Mr. Wilson would be appreciated to help us figure that out.
Chair Comp, absolutely. We've put together some kind of charts that show within the regions these various collaboratives, what they're working on, what their priorities are, what their focus is. And so I think that it would be a good piece of information. And then to come, you've heard, I believe you've heard the presentations around the early learning hubs.
Yes, they're competing for your fund. The funds are, yeah, in competition.
Complementing.
Well.
And you will hear in the OEIB's budget presentation more about the regional achievement collaboratives and more about the STEM and CTE hubs as well.
Okay, we have Representative Huffman and then Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the $25 million doesn't come out, and I'm kidding, Doug. Whitney,
no, it doesn't come out of Doug's salary.
If I missed it, I apologize. The lead agency on the $50,000 planning grant and then the $2 million, is it Regional Solutions, or who's kind of taking the lead on that in each workforce region?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. So the regions themselves would be able to designate from because the collaboratives are made up of sets of partners, in some cases they're governed by an actual governing body. In other cases they're governed in a different kind of collaborative loose governance structure. And so we would leave it to the region to determine a lead agency within one of those entities, or a lead you know, party. In some cases it might be a nonprofit organization, in some cases a community college, in some cases an education service district has been at the center of many of these efforts. And so the regions themselves would identify who would receive the planning grant. I think the incentive for them to come to that agreement would really be that the dollars are kind of contingent on them coming to a plan.
Follow-up. So are they called education collaboratives? Is that what you, or you mentioned collaborative. Who is the collaborative?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. So within the region, we're looking toward bringing several sets of collaboratives together to be developing a plan for the region. And those would include coordinated care organizations, which are working on the health care transformation, early learning hubs, which are working specifically on the early learning outcomes, regional achievement collaboratives, which are the kind of collections of P20 education partners and community members, workforce investment boards, which I believe you'll hear more about in the workforce days that are coming ahead, that are really the kind of body that prioritizes workforce investments, and regional solutions, which are the sort of cross-sector advisory committees that are determining economic development priorities for regions. So among that collection of interests, they would identify what was the most logical kind of lead to go ahead with the planning grant. It sounds complicated, and in some regions it is. In other regions, for example, Southern Oregon, they have created an umbrella sort of collaborative called Southern Oregon Success that is already bringing together their workforce board, their regional solutions, their education partners, and kind of creating this kind of complex but elegant alignment and a plan for the region to be able to move forward in these efforts.
And your geographic area is a little bigger, so you'll have to get busy.
Well, yeah, and I'm just, I mean, we have new local workforce regions and boards, and so central is the Columbia River to California border, that whole central swath, and a lot of the folks that sit on the boards that you mentioned come together under regional solutions. And so anyway, I'm just trying to think in my area how and who.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
I could read your mind. Senator Roblin.
I just want to say, and thank you, Madam Chair, I really like the fact that this is not divided up necessarily by population, because there are these frontier districts that population-wise, whenever we give out money by population, they get these 0.1, 0.5, and 0.7 people who they finally put all together, and this one person is responsible for an amazing array of things, and finding that person is oftentimes very difficult. At least this says, here's $2 million, you can organize it, and it actually gives you enough money to get a person that can do some of this kind of stuff and do some of the other things. And I appreciate that conversation, because they may have a harder job in some of these frontier districts to bring people together than we're going to have in these smaller districts, where you actually know each other and can see each other, and you don't have to spend 3 days to get to each other. So by having them as a grant that gives you the same amount as the tightly one with the big one, it actually gives them a chance to hire a person to help with coordination and do some of this kind of stuff that we don't get to do a lot of times in some of these little districts when we're trying to package it all together. And so I appreciate the thought, and I do believe that we'll get a lot more work out of all these different regional groups if they actually know what each other's doing. And so I'm happy somebody's thinking about that. So thank you.
Thank you for the work on this, because it is complex. So thanks, Whitney.
And Madam Chair, I just want to point out, in sort of light of Representative Huffman, this is a new ask, so there is nothing in the current service level, or for that matter, in the co-chair's budget framework for this. So if you were to fund all or part of this, at least at this time, it would come out of the $60 million.
So I wasn't joking.
No. That's why I thought I'd better say it.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Along with the $85 million for early learning, yes. So now we've got over 150.
Now we're getting over 200, I think. I'm afraid we're above 200 now.
Oh, yeah.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
I'm sorry. I do this. But that $60 million is sounding more and more like 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes.
Yeah. And it's up to you to bake the bread.
Yeah, right. Bless them.
Please proceed. Unless we're just all aghast at how much this is.
Mr. Wilson, I think, ended us on a down note, but
I would call it a realist note, I'm sorry.
But no, I think we're done. Thank you.
Okay.
So, Madam Co-Chair, yes, and staff, I think we're prepared to move on to day 7, so it'll mean potentially calling up. I don't know, maybe it's, yeah.
Okay, and let's see if we can stick to, at the most, about 15 minutes. Again, some of us are getting to our 10 o'clock meetings, which we have no choice in how they're set, and we're getting to those late.
Great. So we'll get started. And
Doug, did you have a comment?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to say this next presentation, day 7 and 8, are found on today's OLA, or today's setting for OLAS.
Okay. Just found them.
31st?
Yep.
Yes.
I haven't gotten there yet, but go ahead.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So we turn our attention now to community colleges specifically. So after having talked about affordability and talked about pathways in and out of and within higher education, we're going to focus now on some institutions, and specifically Oregon 17 Community Colleges. And I'm going to turn this over to Jim to really lead the presentation, but I do want to say just this, that community colleges quite clearly are the engine of our 40-40-20 goals and the engine of higher education in Oregon. And I think what makes that particularly clear is the role that they play in the middle 40, quite evidently, through the production of certificates and degrees that are associated very closely with that middle 40, but also high school completion. We've talked about GEDs and that portion of our 40-40-20 goals. And our, I don't like to call it upper 40 or top 40, but our most advanced 40, the bachelor's degrees and above. One stat that sticks with me, and I think we have it reflected probably in the university's presentation actually, is that the majority of Oregon resident BA recipients from our public universities last year, the majority of those who walked across the stage and earned their BAs started at a community college. And it's just a stunning testament to the role that community colleges play in helping deliver, again, not merely in the middle 40, but the what do I call it, advanced 40, as well as their work in workforce training and high school completion or its equivalent. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
Okay, and we have a comment from Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Might I propose first 40 rather than top 40? It's all I've could come up with on
yes.
that short a timeline, but
Madam Co-Chair,
if top 40 is bothering you that much,
yes,
then I
yeah,
just
definitely
wanted to
not
give you an
top
option.
40. I think we're definitely not calling it the top 40. We've used upper 40 a lot along with
40.
Middle, but I appreciate the suggestion, and we'll continue to work on the verbiage. All suggestions welcome.
Merriam-Webster's helpful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. And we're going to talk more later on about the role of CCWD as an office, a proposed office within the HEC. Jim Middleton, our interim commissioner, has led that agency since June of last year, July of last year, last summer, let's call it, is in the final couple of months, and we'll be looking for his successor to lead the office as it comes fully within the HEC umbrella, but really glad that Jim can lead us through this today.
So you're announcing two retirees in one day?
Sadly, Co-Chair yes. Comp, yes. I currently have failed my first retirement and am working to succeed on my second.
Okay.
So. For the record, Jim Middleton, Interim Commissioner, CCWD. Ben covered it all and I'm done. Thank you. This is relative to POPs 101 and 111, which are fundamentally replacing the tuition buy-down on a continuing basis and the expansion of the Community College Support Fund. It also includes additional funds for debt service. There are no additional capital projects for community colleges this year. This is an increase paying for prior approved projects. As you well know, just very quickly, we are a mosaic that covers...
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jim, but before we gloss over it too quickly, the $30 million tuition buy-down continuation, I know particularly through the recession how that had to work, but when we're asking for more from Oregon Opportunity Grant, how would this differ from the OOG?
The what?
Oregon Opportunity Grant. Yeah.
No.
Not going there?
No.
Oogie.
Sorry, we are
good. Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. This is continuing the community support fund at the level that it allowed the colleges to either eliminate or reduce what the tuition amounts were. So
rather than calling it out as a separate amount, it's trying to put that in as the continuing amount.
Okay.
Follow to keep you within the maximum percentage that we had to keep tuition down overall.
Yeah, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. What it is really accomplishing is if we had not done this, the colleges would have had to actually go back and increase tuition to produce the funds that would have covered, in fact, a reduction of funding, and then look at any other additional that would have been for, you know, the new biennium.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering if it's basically a tuition buy-down, and it's universal to the community college budget. Just kind of wondering if, you know, we're looking at 435 or 535.
Yeah.
And
co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. I think, you know, we're in that mathematical issue that when we did the rollover of the budget, it rolled back to what the funding would be without the tuition buy-down. And what we're trying to do is to get that, for all parties, that amount of money to be part of what the continuing amount is rather than it always being called out as a separate amount. So hopefully this would be the last time that we would be talking about, and this funds the tuition buy down.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. Can you talk to us a little bit about the debt service and how that impacts tuition increases or does or does not? And obviously the debt service is going up. I'm concerned about it at the community college level and at the university level,
yes,
and that it's being transferred over to an increase in tuition.
Representatives Comp and Monroe, co-chairs, and Representative Taylor. As my CFO when I was at Central Oregon Community College said, you can only spend a dollar once. So at one level, as you are struggling with the broader arena, dollars that go into capital are not available for consideration of going into other arenas, though technically they are not, you know, from the same arena. So this is additional funding for projects that were approved in prior biennia and were implemented during the last 2 years that are a pickup in those areas. Part of the agreement in the prior biennium was that the community colleges would not request additional capital funding for this biennium.
Follow-up.
Yes.
The debt has to be paid one way or the other.
Yes.
So it can be directly from the state to pay down the debt, or the cost can be transferred over to students, and then they will have to pay it off.
Right.
One way or the other, the debt has to be paid, and so it leaves less funds available for things like tuition buy-down. I'm not saying that the debt isn't worthwhile and that the projects aren't worthwhile, but that's a pretty big increase, obviously. The $10 million, it's a pretty big increase. And so, and I'm just wondering if we're on a trajectory. I understand you may not be having an ask now, but some decisions had to be made to get us to the $37 million over the last several biennium. And I'm wondering if there's a long-term plan of how much more debt. You're retiring, so maybe it's the next person, but there may be some other folks can speak about it. I think Mr. McGee may have some expertise in this area too. So,
well, and Ben, Mr.
Or maybe
Wilson,
Doug.
Yeah. Mr. Wilson has a comment.
And help me, Bill, if you can, because you've been around this area more than I have. The debt we're looking at here are state bonds,
right,
and they're paid. At the same time, these types of bonds, based on the Constitution, require a local equal match in cash or basically cash contribution, which the colleges raise themselves, often through bond issues at the local level, fundraising, and other mechanisms that they come forward with to pay. So this is really sort of a partnership, but the debt service that's listed on this page is the state share of that. Now, whether there's a long-range plan or not, my guess is that the colleges themselves sort of have individual long-range plans, but at the state level, I don't think it's quite that formal. Mr. McGee might disagree, but You know, these can't come in. There were requests made last session, but the decision was made that I think all of the community colleges received some type of project assistance last year, and therefore there was a sort of an understanding that there would not be any requests this year because of the experience last year. Mr. McGee, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Bill McGee, DES. Two points I'd like to make. One, the clarification. The $37.7 million is actually less than the amount of debt service that would be owed in all the general obligation bonds that have been already authorized. Mm-hmm. In the governor's budget, we took a $9.6 million reduction in general fund because it appears to us that there will be a significant number of colleges that will not generate their match in time in this biennium for us to owe that debt. So assuming when they get their match, they sell the bonds, if you reauthorize them, the currently approved project debt in the long term is about $9.6 million larger than this. So second point is Governor Kitzhaber issued an executive order about 2 or 3 years ago that would develop a process by which the state would look at its long-term capital basis. He recommended that of the debt capacity that was available each biennium, about 25% of that be reserved for education, 25% for economic development, and there were two other categories that I'm not recalling the amounts of the debts right now. But that was an attempt to think about where the state expends its debt in the long run and to allocate it in terms of the different categories of things that need to be taken care of. I think it's fair to say that the debt in post-secondary increased enormously over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yes.
And part of the reason for that was during the two recessions, in the early 2000s and the last recession, the legislature was unable to provide much in the way of operating funds. Mm-hmm. What the legislature and the governor could do at that point was to provide capital projects that would provide some additional educational capacity to the universities and the community colleges and would also have an economic development effect, and then at least in the short term during the construction period there would be some jobs. But the result is that in post-secondary, when you include the colleges, the universities, and OSSU, you'll be getting close to $240, $250 million in the 15-17 biennium on debt service for these projects. And you have a $9.6 billion co-chair budget in education, that $240 million has to come out of that. So in a sense that, as Mr. Middleton said, you can only spend the dollar once.
Yes.
And so there really is a trade-off here between what you spend on debt and what you spend on operations.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. I have to brag a little bit for Mr. McGee is a very modest man. I worked with him briefly when I was at the Secretary of State's office, and he's highly competent, and so I like to ask him questions because he really knows his stuff. So
we'll give you 5 minutes at the most.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Mr. McGee. So you said that Governor Kitzhaber had, you know, had kind of come up with this longer plan and saying about how we're going to, you know, issue the debt. Or how much we're willing to go into debt, I guess, is what it was.
Right.
What is that? Do you have any ideas that's still going on? Does Doug know? Does anybody know? Or is there? I just want there to be some sort of plan and who's in charge of that for the long term of making these decisions for the debt.
On bonding debt?
Yeah.
Can I answer that, Madam Chair?
Oh, good. I'm glad someone knows.
Well.
In just a minute, Ann, your credentials to answer that?
Well, I'm on the Capital
Brown.
Construction Subcommittee, which does the bonding.
Okay, go
good.
For it.
So we had the bonding tutorial a week and a half ago that was given to the Debt Commission.
I want this on record so we all can understand. You might get a little closer to the microphone.
So the Debt Commission is brought up to date by Laura Lockwood McCall, which is the person in charge of bonding through the Treasurer's Office. And so because of our potential increased revenue, our overall expenditure from the general lottery funds is going to be at about 3.5%. The maximum level that we would want for the total bonding within reason is 5 to 5.5% of the general lottery fund budget, which is about $18.5 billion or something like that projected. So these numbers are within... $18.5 billion.
Okay.
In round figures. I don't remember the exact number.
That's
so this would be a part of that 3.5% payback, if you will, the debt service annually or biennially. I don't remember if this was probably a biennial number, but anyway. So the Debt Commission then makes a recommendation to legislative leadership as to, we're looking at $964 million, I think, in general fund bonding capacity to stay within that reasonable realm of debt service, and then about $164 million on lottery fund bonding capacity that we could do for the 15-17 biennium. Did I kind of answer it?
Yes.
Sorry, there was a lot of numbers, but it was a good presentation.
Thank you. We can go on.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, since we're running out of time, I've got some numbers that I need. In 2007, when you and I started this little game, we were at $500 million in the community college fund. And it dropped down as low as $395 million. And this year, the governor comes in back up at $500 million. The co-chairs are at $535 million. I'd like to know what's happened to tuition between 2007 and today. I'd like to know what the inflation factor would be if the community college fund had grown with inflation per student between 2007 and today. What would the number be? And you know, because I suspect that even at 535, we're not matching inflation, and that tuition during this period of time has increased pretty significantly at most community colleges, partly because the state has reduced the amount of real funding. So those are some numbers I'd like to look at, because we're going to be asked, we kicked out the K-12 budget last week, but we're going to be asked to vote on a community college budget at some point this year, and we need that information to make a rational choice, and then of course we have to look at the resources available. But the co-chairs Devlin and Buckley told me that one of the things they were trying to do in their budget was get back up in terms of community college funding and OUS funding, reverse the trend that's been dropping, reverse it and get it moving back in the right direction again. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And Ben or Mr. Middleton, do you have a final, quote or saying to take us out of here on a positive note?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, probably just makes sense with your timeline to carry over.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your work today. Mr. McGee, thank you for your expertise. Thank you for your expertise. Your work today. Mr.